It's a fairly generally recognized principle that approaches to reality, ways of understanding life, don't just go out of business from one day on one year or one century to the other. The only teachings that disappear are ones that are, first of all, let's say, extremely closely connected with, intertwined with, some particular ethnic unit and culture, such as, let us say, the religion of the pharaohs, of ancient of pharaonic Egypt. When pharaonic Egypt passed out of history, the worldview of ancient pharaonic Egypt also passed out of history. And it is, in spite of its great merits and extremely fascinating, interesting features, it remained a matter of purely antiquarian interest to the present time. Now, there are many Egyptologists who concern themselves with that, but it is no longer a living tradition, except if we want to make a very, very broad definition by way of the manner in which the ancient Egyptian spirituality influenced different other schools of thought, but in itself it is no longer there. Let's say for some reason of history, the people and the culture of India would cease to exist. I don't know whatever could bring such a thing about. Certainly all kinds of things could. Well, then the likelihood is that Hinduism would no longer be a living tradition, because again, it is a very ethnic kind of spirituality. It is very closely tied in with one particular people and its traditions. But such was certainly not the case with the various great spiritual movements of the Hellenistic era, just prior to and just after the coming of the Christian religion, such as Gnosticism, Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, Neopythagoreanism, and so forth. If these schools of spirituality had anything in common, it was certainly, or certainly one of the most important things that they had in common, was that they were extremely universal. They were not the property of any particular ethnic group or even of any particular culture. And as such, of course, in spite of their external vicissitudes, they never really ceased. Certainly, Gnosticism did not cease, even though, beginning with the 3rd century and going into the 4th, the dominant Christian religion turned away from the minority of Christian Gnostics, whom prior to that time it had tolerated, and who at various times even exercised a considerable influence, and declared them heretical, and drove them out of the mainstream of the Christian faith. The tradition nevertheless managed to perpetuate itself in various ways. The only thing that it could do, of course, was within the Christian orbit, that is, was to go underground. There was one great manifestation where, and I'll finish this historical part very, very shortly, there was one great manifestation of Gnosticism which was able to function in a public manner for a considerable period of time, and that became very influential, spread clear over into Asia, into places like China, and possibly Tibet, and the south of India, and that was Manichaeism. Called by that name because of its great prophet, the 4th century Persian religious teacher, whose name was Mani, and who established a form of Gnosticism primarily in Persia or Iran, from whence, however, by way of missionary activities, it spread to many places, including clear to Central Asia. However, there also in Persia there were political reversals, and then Manichaeism was persecuted. But it became a big, very populous and very influential religion for a considerable period of time. Further west, however, the tradition functioned in an underground manner, but it would surface in history from time to time. A very good analogy for this phenomenon that has been made is that of a sort of underground river, a body of water that moves underneath the surface of the earth. It is there, although you don't see it. It nourishes all kinds of growth on the surface of the earth that couldn't grow without it. And from time to time, where the geological conditions permit, it breaks out to the surface and runs on the surface of the earth for a while and then goes underground again. So that is pretty much the way the Gnostic tradition continued in various places in Europe, in the Mediterranean area, and then of course with the dispersal of European culture in various parts of the world, representatives of it arose also elsewhere. Just to put it very briefly again, major eruptions, let's say, of the underground stream that we know of and that can be identified, I think, without the least shadow of a doubt as being of an explicitly Gnostic character, are the Cathars in what is now the south of France, who functioned there in a fairly public manner for around a century, and who in the 13th century were then in very very violent and very very cruel manner driven out of existence, at least outwardly, once again by the Catholic Church in the form of a crusade, the only crusade ever conducted against fellow Christians. Around the same time, 12th, 13th, and 14th century, also in the Balkans and in the southern part of Europe, the so-called Bogomils, Gnostic groups very closely related to the Cathars. The only difference between these medieval Gnostics, let's say, and the ancient ones back in the 1,000 years earlier, was that by this time the expression of the Gnostic mythology was put forth in a much more medieval Christian manner than was the case before. So that, let us say, the mythology now, the manner in which Gnosticism expressed itself, in its verbiage, adapted itself much more to the kinds of concepts and the kinds of imagery that were commonly available to people in Europe at that time. But in their essential content, in the essential worldview, all of these were always very Gnostic. There were also various small groups that survived in the Middle East. Among these, perhaps the most important, who are functioning even today and who functioned in an unbroken succession since that time are the so-called Mandaeans, which is not to be confused with Manichaeans. Manda being a word in ancient Aramaic meaning gnosis. These people were undoubtedly originally Jews who were driven out of the Palestine, Judaic, Judea area by various people, particularly by the Jews themselves, and who then lived in various places in Mesopotamia, in the area which now is Iraq, out in the countryside and in the area between the Tigris and the Euphrates River for many, many centuries in great privacy and in great seclusion, but who now can be found in various parts of Iraq, primarily in the cities, in Baghdad, in Basra, in places like that, and who are by no means just the rural people by now, but are primarily tradesmen, silversmiths and people of that sort, and who are respected the religious minority in Iraq, even respected by the Muslims, which is not easy to come by, and even respected by the government of Saddam Hussein, which is probably even more difficult to come by. Unlike the Kurds and various other minorities, they have not been bothered. Certainly they are, their teachings, their worldview is of a very, very distinct and very definite Gnostic character. There were underground movements, especially in various parts of Europe, that continued up to the present time, who now, with the much greater religious freedom, also with the rediscovery of the Nag Hammadi materials and so forth, have surfaced. And so you hear the word Gnostic mentioned much more often nowadays, and you will probably hear it mentioned even much more frequently in the future, even as this often is the case, especially here in this country. Not all is gold that glitters, and not everyone who calls himself a Gnostic really deserves that name, but there are certainly some who do, and there are many who are working at this in a very dedicated and very sincere manner. So what you are interested in, of course, is primarily what is the content, what are these people teaching, what are these people practicing, and so forth. And while we have gained an overall impression, I think primarily in mythological terms before, it would be probably useful to summarize some of the individual points of the Gnostic worldview in a useful manner, in a comprehensible manner, so that we can recognize when we encounter a Gnostic type of teaching somewhere in the culture at the present time. In order to do that, I have availed myself of a few sources here where people have tried to summarize in a few separate distinct points, let's say, the main body of the Gnostic teaching. And one of these is found in a book actually written about William Blake, who is regarded by many literary and religious scholars as a Gnostic himself. A book about William Blake written by, or rather an introduction to one of the commentaries on one of Blake's works by a a man who at that time was probably still is, a professor at the University of Miami in Florida by the name of Clark Emery. And while I have maybe minor disagreements with one or two of his points, I think they are very well stated, and they are stated by a reputable religious scholar. So I will use these points by Emery. I will read them as he has stated them, and then I will comment on each one. So here is what he says. The Gnostics, though they varied in specific points, tended to agree in the following general beliefs. Well, belief is perhaps not an entirely accurate word, but let's say the following tenets of a worldview. The first of these, which he mentions, number one, they posited an original spiritual unity, which came to be split into a plurality. Not an unheard of idea. You find it in Taoism, you find it in various Eastern religions in addition to that. In the beginning, before all else, there was the One. The One, from the One came the Two, say the Taoists, and from the Two came the 10,000 myriad things. If you look at the Kabbalah, you find a very similar idea also. There is nevertheless an important issue that runs through all of this, and that we need to keep in mind, is that the Gnostic worldview does not look upon the manifest universe and the various beings within it as merely, or perhaps let's say primarily, the creations, the manufacture of a god. We are not made primarily by a being outside of ourselves, but rather we are part of a greater being. We are the scattered fragments, let us say, of the One. We come from there. We are essentially part of that. As you may remember from our last discussion, the celestial being in the hymn of the robe of glory, the hymn of the pearl, who leaves heaven, comes down to earth and comes back, is a child, a direct offspring of the heavenly father and mother. So in effect, he is a divine being. Well, in this same fashion, we might say that according to the Gnosis, in its origin and in its essence, everything that is comes directly from the One. The One pours itself out into manifestation, and thus in manifestation becomes the many. The second point that Emery puts forth is that as a result of this pre-cosmic division, because this occurs in the Gnostic writings prior to the time that any definite cosmos is formed yet. This is a long process. As a result of this pre-cosmic division, the universe also was created. It was created by a leader possessing inferior spiritual powers, a leader often having the appearance of the Old Testament Jehovah. So, this is an important issue, very important issue, and one that is not readily understood and readily distinguished. That although all comes from the One, although the essence, the substance of everything goes back to the original fountain, in the course of the coming forth or emanating certain unusual situations, certain unusual changes have occurred. Among these there is the arising of alienation. What is alienation? If you say that you are alienated from, I don't know, your family, or you are alienated, you are estranged. That's what this means. You know, an alien is a stranger. An estrangement takes place of certain portions of that which came forth from the One in the course of this long, long process. And this estrangement then brings about various results. You might say, what would give the Gnostics this kind of a strange idea? How would anyone arrive at the notion that something has gone wrong in the course of creation, or that there might be creating agencies, or as he puts it here, a leader possessing inferior spiritual powers might have somehow arisen within this process and started creating things, including our present universe wherein which we live. You must admit, this is not a notion that occurs very frequently in spiritual traditions. Well, the main reason we may find why, let's say, this situation has been postulated by the Gnostics, how it has been discovered, is the presence of evil in the world. Whether one says that the universe was created, you know, like manufactured, made by a god outside of the universe, as the monotheistic religions generally say, or whether one says, like the Hindus say, and in another much more subtle way, the Buddhists, Taoists, that the universe is an outflow of the One, none of these creation myths, none of these ways of accounting for existence, have really a very useful way of accounting for evil. Where did evil enter the picture? If a good God created the world and ourselves in it, why isn't the world good? And why aren't we good? So Judaism and Christianity, for instance, to some extent Islam, went to great lengths to come up with an extremely tortured and peculiar story, if we can look at it objectively, to account for that. The story of the Garden of Eden, of two innocent, newly created people, who were just sort of fooling around there, bored in their original condition, and who, while doing so, kind of half-consciously transgressed a rule set up by the Creator, and this trivial transgression is supposed to have resulted in unbelievable cosmic catastrophe, a fall of such momentous consequences, both in terms of the immediate consequences and in terms of the endurance of the consequences throughout time, that we are still afflicted thereby. You must admit, once you kind of divorce yourself from this ancestral myth within which we were all brought up, that this is a very peculiar way of accounting for the evils, the imperfection, the perversities, and the terrible things that exist in the universe and upon our earth and in our own lives. The On the other hand, if we take the sort of much more monistic or even pantheistic vision that we encounter, for instance, in the East, in Taoism and Hinduism, and to a minor extent in Buddhism, because Buddhism is really much more affinitized to Gnosticism than anything else, but let's say like in Taoism and Hinduism, there also the question arises, if all is God, if Brahman or whatever we may call it, you know, Parabrahman, the Tao, manifested in the by way of the two and the many and so forth, if everything is part of God, and God is essentially good, then how can this thing that is God at the same time have so much darkness and so much evil in it? Where did it come from? And there is no particularly no particularly logical answer given to this in Hinduism or in Taoism either. So whether we look at the one position, a pantheistic, monistic position that everything is part of God, or whether we take the monotheistic position that we have in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Zoroastrianism, none of these folk have really a what I would call a particularly decent way of accounting for evil. And so the Gnostics, on the other hand, accounted for it in a certain way. They accounted for it by saying that something went wrong. That just because all of this energy, all of this power, this substance, whatever we wish to call it, this impulse, came from supernal goodness, that does not ensure that in the course of its development certain things may not go wrong. Not any more than our own often very commendable intentions in carrying out various projects in life ensure that these projects are not going to go wrong. How many times in your life did you have the best of intentions, availed yourself of the best of available instrumentalities to carry out your intentions, and yet in the course of your activities all kinds of things went wrong? Now, of course, a rigid monotheist would say, well, but God is omnipotent and nothing can go wrong with him. But if you look into the Judeo-Christian Bible, the Old and New Testament, and so even there you will find that a lot of God's projects tend to go wrong again and again, even though he is omnipotent. Never stopped him from having various things that he started to turn out badly. Including his only begotten son being nailed to a great big cross and killed in a cruel manner, and all kinds of things earlier on. This is why various contemporary people, as for instance another man for whom I have the highest possible regard, the late Swiss psychologist C.G. Jung, said, the Gnostics are the only ones who manage to account for the presence of evil in the world and in our lives in anything resembling a reasonable manner. They had an explanation, they had a story, which while it may not appeal to a lot of people, does make more sense than others that have been advanced by the so-called big orthodoxies of the world. Namely, that something becomes alienated, forms of consciousness arise within this divine stream that flows out into creation, who have forgotten who they are, who no longer have a clear understanding of their own role and of their own origins, and who then undertake certain projects of their own, which obviously, because they are they originate in a flawed and imperfect kind of mind, themselves come to embody great flaws and imperfections. Certainly if one looks at many gods of the world, whether in the polytheistic pantheons of people such as the Hindus, whether in the monotheistic system of the Jews or the Zoroastrians, and of course the Christians and the Muslims who inherited these, you find that the God or the gods responsible for creation there very often bear, let's say, a very imperfect image. Certainly it has struck many people when they read the Old Testament that the Old Testament God is neither particularly smart nor particularly ethically good, even though he's supposed to have created an ethical system of great magnitude. And so when the Gnostics pointed to these things, they said, look at your gods. I mean, these gods are not good, whether they are Jupiter or Zeus or Jehovah, you know, they are imperfect. So you already have this idea, the concept of an imperfect God who does peculiar things. You know, I don't know if you ever tried to read the Old Testament from cover to cover. It's a dreary undertaking. You know, I think you'd be very likely to put it down and turn on the television. You know, even if you don't have cable, you might find something a little bit better. You know, but if you try, the things that you find there that are attributed to God are unbelievably weird and hair-raising. You know. And certainly often very, very primitive and unethical and cruel and so forth. And the only reason that people don't revolt against this sort of thing more is because they don't read it. They don't know anything about it, or they repress it. And the preachers, well, and the rabbis, well, you know, that's different. They make their living out of this stuff, so they have to overlook it. That's a good enough reason. So there is now this concept of a secondary kind of deity who is neither as good nor as wise as the original God, but who manages to create a world nevertheless, a world that is flawed in the image of this flawed God. Now comes the third point, which is fairly universal in Gnosticism, although let's say in the medieval Gnosticism it is muted, while it's much more explicitly present in Valentinian Gnosticism, some of the earlier Gnosticism, and that is in Professor Emery's formulation, a female emanation from God was involved in the cosmic creation. Another complicating factor. This female emanation, where it is, its presence is openly stated, is known in the Gnostic systems as Sophia, which means wisdom. Sophia appears, or wisdom, appears with reasonable strength in the Judeo-Christian scriptures as well, because as probably some of you know, there is a whole literature of the Old Testament, the so-called wisdom literature, which the most important document of which is the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon. Some of these, incidentally, have been declared apocryphal by the Protestants, such as the English King James, who is responsible for with his scholars for the King James Bible. You know, fairly nice old Scotsman, and but certainly not some kind of an inspired prophet. They didn't like the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon and think that they cut it out, but it's an important book of the Bible. So there's the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon, the Book of Ecclesiastes, the Book of Ecclesiasticus, which the two which are not the same. The Song of Songs, or Canticle of Canticles, also attributed to King Solomon. And these are sort of the main body of the wisdom literature, and they all speak of a curious kind of metaphysical being. When they talk about wisdom, they always call her she. Now, you know, there's a personification there that is feminine. Now, this image, this archetype, whatever you wish to call it, this deific being, was, let's say, explained in much greater detail by the old Gnostics. And they said, in effect, that there was a kind of high emanation of God, like a daughter of God, whose name is Sophia, or wisdom, because she embodies the wisdom of God. And that she acted as a kind of a counterpart to this much more unwise, this much more stupid creator God who made the material universe and a lot of others, but she was there trying to, ameliorate some of this. Let me indicate to you very, very quickly some concrete example that occurs about that, let's say, in the Nag Hammadi scriptures. For instance, in some of the Nag Hammadi scriptures, like the hypostasis of the Archons, the paraphrase of Shem on the creation of the world, in some of these treatises, you find interesting stories about how the human was created, for instance. There is the demiurge, the archon, this leader possessing inferior spiritual powers, as Emery so nicely says, gets an idea, he's going to create a man. So he looks around and he looks up into the sky, just like a painter might, or somebody who wants inspiration for something. You know, I often see all kinds of weird things in the sky, especially if you have nice clouds, which we seldom have around here. And so he sees up in the upper regions an image. And this is the image of the celestial man. This is what in Hebrew is called the Adam Kadmon, and appears in the Kabbalah and so forth. It's really a divine image, a divine archetype. This looks like something nice. I'm going to make a man who looks like that. So he creates a form that resembles the heavenly man, and this is the human form, but this is Adam. But what happens with Adam, and we'll hear more about him later on, he looks like that heavenly man, but he isn't anything like that. In fact, he is he's like a cripple. He can't walk. He crawls around on all four, as perhaps our ancestors did in evolutionary terms, if you want to accept that. And so he's a miserable, crippled, kind of stupid creature. And Sophia, the wisdom lady, is looking down at this and says, oh my God, what has this guy done, you know? Look at this miserable abortion that she created here. We can't have this. So she comes along and brings the spirit of God, the Ruach, as it would be called in Hebrew, you know, and breathes it into him. And Adam gets up and starts walking, which is sort of already in these mythologies kind of the sign of being a human, you know, and of course becomes much wiser, and then proceeds the creation of the female and so forth. So the form of the human was given by this this stupid leader, but the intelligence was given to the human by Sophia. So a lot of people have said down through the ages, and there are certainly indications of that in the Gnostic scriptures too, that this is something very much like, or rather affinitized to, the Holy Spirit. That the presence of Sophia in the world is a sort of a form, a manifestation of what in the New Testament is called the Holy Spirit. So a female emanation from God was involved in the cosmic creation, as he says, but involved in a much more positive manner than the other fellow. Number four, in the cosmos, space and time have a malevolently spiritual character and may be personified as demonic beings separating man from God. Well, this is a further elaboration of the notion of the leader possessing inferior powers. What has been made, the environment, and by this environment we must think not only of physical environment, in fact that's only a very small part of it, but psychological environment too, within which we exist. This psychological environment is not terribly benign in as far as our spiritual nature and the possible realization of our spiritual potential are concerned. We have a certain deck stacked against us in this world in spiritual terms. That is why we are not aware of who we really are. That is why we are not really aware of what this is all about. That is why most of us don't have even the much of a desire and a motivation to find out. Because all of these influences within which we find ourselves are inimical to our own spiritual nature. That is not to say that some help is not available, but we find ourselves in a rather hostile environment, spiritually speaking. You know, that's not entirely untrue, even in physical terms. Look at, for instance, how much easier it is, up to a certain point, for most animals to get a footing and get going in this world compared to ourselves. You have a dog, you have a cat, they have puppies and kittens and things like that. Before you have a chance to read a couple of books, they are already bigger than their parents. They mature extremely quickly. They're able to fend for themselves very soon. You have a child yourself, heck, they are 18 years old, 20 years old, they still don't fend for themselves. Maybe even 30, the way the world is now. The reason being really that the human doesn't find it so easy to function in this world. The human has a lot of difficulties. And it's really in part, this is my exegesis now, of course, and I'm not quoting some kind of ancient source, but let's say it is conceivable that it is because of these difficulties that we constantly experience that we are so anxious to create complex civilizations, complex systems, that we build such big houses and vehicles that run on the surface of the earth and fly in the air and everything else, because we have so much stacked against us. Animals don't make a civilization because they have within themselves the tools of their own survival up to a certain point. Of course, there is the food chain. They are not all supposed to survive. But we have a different situation. So there is definitely a set of great difficulties, and these difficulties are not purely material, but as Dr. Emery very correctly calls them, they have a malevolently spiritual character. This is the sort of thing that St. Paul the Apostle, the most important figure in the early Christian movement, refers to as spiritual wickedness in high places. That we fight not only against flesh and blood, not only against trivial things, but against the whole system, which ultimately is spiritual, but is still something that causes us trouble, that still has a malevolent character, and that we have to overcome. So, you know, this kind of largely 18th and 19th century sort of intellectual hogwash, if you pardon the expression, and if you don't pardon it, I'll still use it, the universe is friendly, is just that, it's hogwash. The universe is not friendly. We carve out of the universe little niches for ourselves, where usually for very short periods of time we feel a little bit protected, a little bit safe. But doggone it, if we trusted the universe entirely, it's like trusting a tiger. There are so many dangers. Now I know there are a lot of people who don't talk this way, but then I'm not a lot of people. I'm just one, and I'm trying to show you the Gnostic picture. So this has now to do with the existential condition which has a certain impact upon us. I will refuse to use in bad English and say it impacts on us, but has an impact on us. Of in the nature of certain grave difficulties. Now, the fifth point, which flows from this, for man, the universe is a vast prison. He is enslaved both by the physical laws of nature and by such psychic laws as the Mosaic Code, namely the Code of Moses. Well, he is now going back, of course, to various early sources, because the Gnostics, even as for that matter, practically all of the early Christians, had their disagreements with Judaic law, of course. But, so here is another existential point. We are in a prison. We are in constant limitation. The things that we would like to do, we cannot do. I challenge anybody on the face of this earth, even the late J. Paul Getty or anybody, you know, with a great deal of money and power, let's bring him back from the grave and ask him, you know, why not? Although, geez, I don't know if I wanted to conjure anybody, I don't think I would want to conjure that old coot. But, as to whether they could ever really do what they wanted to do. And if they were honest, they would say no. Because nobody can. We are all under this kind of limitation. So limitation is one of the features of our existence. And what happens as the result of limitation in our lives? Frustration. When we are limited, we are frustrated. Now, as the sixth point, now he goes on somewhat into the myth, mankind may be personified as Adam, who lies in the deep sleep of ignorance, his powers of spiritual self-awareness stupefied by materiality. Because in the book of Genesis it is stated that Adam was lying in a sleep. He was in that kind of a sleep when the rib was taken out of him and Eve was created. So we lie in a deep sleep of ignorance, and our powers of spiritual self-awareness are stupefied by, I wouldn't even just say materiality, as Emery says, but by our existential condition. Our condition makes us a lot more stupid than we need to be. That's the nature of our situation. Psychologically, we might say that what we are dealing with here is a constant struggle against unconsciousness. George Gurdjieff, a modern teacher who again had a lot in common with the Gnostics in certain ways, said that most people in this world are sleepwalkers. Humans are asleep. They don't know it, but they are asleep. And so they need to be awakened by various self-directed and self-involved spiritual disciplines, otherwise they continue being asleep. Because that is the nature of our condition. Now, all of this so far, right down here to point six, which is about halfway down Dr. Emery's list, is kind of pretty discouraging. I would say that the only sort of nice and optimistic point was the very first one, that there was an original glorious unity, which then came to be split into a plurality, but it's all downhill from there on. However, take heart, it's not really, it doesn't continue that way. In fact, these features which we have mentioned, let's say, so far, or have been summarized here for us, are of course the ones which are used as an excuse by an awful lot of people who take a look at the Gnostic systems are saying, this is a terribly pessimistic system. The same accusation that has been leveled against Buddhism all the time too. But what you need to remember, it is only pessimistic if that's all there is. These conditions which are outlined here and which I at least think are very real, are and can be, let's say, mitigated. When they are set off against something else. And that's true, let's say, about Buddhism also, where, for instance, the fundamental recognition of Gautama the Buddha being that embodied existence, no matter where, no matter what shape, always involves suffering. Everything that is embodied suffers. And now people say, ooh, that's a terrible thing to say. Well, it may be a terrible thing to say, but it's true. At least that's what the Buddhist will say. Why should it be terrible if it's true? Or maybe the truth is terrible, but why should the saying of the terrible truth be more terrible than the terrible truth if you don't say it? You know? of course, people like to gloss over these things. But now, we'd say with the seventh point here, we are beginning to see that part that sets off that when set off against the sad part, begins to bring a certain amount of hope. And here is what he says there. However, within each natural man, he uses the term of St. Paul here again, is an inner man, in parentheses. This is a form spark of the divine substance. Since within each man this spark of holiness exists, the possibility of an awakening from the present stupefaction exists. Incidentally, just as a kind of a little side view, our friends, the existentialists, you know, there's a whole philosophical school called the existentialists. It usually it taken back in its origins to the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, and then all kinds of other people got into the act, Heidegger and Sartre and Husserl and so forth, Camus. The existentialists, pretty much, the existentialists are good Gnostics up to a point. They go kind of right up to including point six in this, because they are very emphatic on the sadness and the hopelessness of human existence. The main point with the existentialists is, however, that they see no way out. They say all you can do is accept this and try to live within it with as much honor and as much rectitude and courage, existential courage, as you can muster. It's okay as far as it goes. Of course, the kind of spiritual commitment, the kind of transcendental spiritual vision that the Gnostics had, the existentialists did not possess. Not even Kierkegaard, who was a religious existentialist. But here we have it. There is a spark of the divine substance within us. But mark it, it's the inner man, it is within us. It's not all of us. It's not the body as such. Not that the body is bad. This is not a misunderstanding, misapprehension. The Gnostics never said the body is bad. They just said, with the body alone, there is only so much you can accomplish. It's limited. It's imperfect. And who on God's earth can deny it? When first of all, everybody dies. Everybody dies. You know? There hasn't been a one yet that didn't. Oh well, there are, you know, stories about Elijah and things like that, but who knows what really went on. So, as the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus, a very wise scripture in itself, says, death is certain for the living. You know what I'm saying? Then it says, rebirth is certain for the dead. It keeps going. So obviously the body, it's not at the level of the body, it's not even at the level of just our psychological nature, but somewhere deeply within us. There is this spark of divine substance. And since this exists, the possibility of an awakening from the present stupefaction exists also. Because there is something inside of us that is capable of being awakened. A seed of wakefulness. A seed of gnosis. The eighth point, what affects the awakening, however, you know, say, okay, we have something inside of us, this spark, this spirit. What do we do? Now he starts out, what effects the awakening is not obedience, not faith, not good works, but knowledge. Very crucial and very heretical. A lot of people wouldn't like it. It sounds cold. Sounds intellectual, but that's not what it is. But it merely says you can be obedient to whoever, your father, your government, your preacher, or your God. You can be obedient till the cows come home. This obedience does not awaken you, does not bring you out into anything. Having faith, well, you know, it depends what you call faith, but faith in the sense of belief, if nice belief had really liberated people, had awakened people, there'd be a lot more liberated, awake people on the face of the earth than we find them. A lot of people have faith, but nothing happens. Speaking of faith, one also always needs to remember a very clever statement that the late American philosopher and early psychologist William James said. Well, you know, most people when they say faith, they mean having faith in someone else's faith. You know, it's several degrees removed from you. So That is not the way it is done. And good works too. That doesn't mean that good works are not effective on their own level, but there is something else. This is what is in Greek is called gnosis, knowledge. The 90s, before the awakening, men undergo troubled dreams. Well, this need not, we need not reflect over this greatly. What the troubled dreams are here are really life experiences. This is, before we are awake to our spiritual nature, life is a troubled dream. We live in a nightmare. It will not do to call it something else than what it is. That's what it is. When we awaken from it, then it's no longer there. In the Anach Hamadi collection, there's a wonderful scripture called the Gospel of Truth, which gives a fabulously beautiful sort of poetic description of what really life is before one awakens, and then what a great difference it is when one wakes up. You see, I mentioned it, I think, the last time when we had such a dense fog outside, that it's like being in a nightmare. One feels menaced by all kinds of things. One feels drawn in one direction, pushed another direction. One stumbles around in a dark fog, in a mist, and one doesn't know what is going on, yet it seems supremely real. But when the awakening comes, one finds that all of this was just nothing. At least in a minor way, I think we had such awakenings ourselves probably many times in our lives. How many times have you been? Maybe you are luckier than I am, but certainly many, many times, again and again, I find myself under circumstances where I feel anxious and menaced, and day and night, you know, these things haunt me and so forth, and then something happens and the whole thing breaks and you look at the situation. There was nothing there to be that anxious about. It was all nothing. It was totally something that the mind has conjured up and kept you in that state of anxiety. There was no objective foundation for it whatsoever. And then it's gone. You know, it vanishes. Because it's of the substance of dreams. It doesn't have any enduring solid quality. These are the troubled dreams. The tenth point is the knowledge. This is the gnosis in Greek. The knowledge that awakens man from these dreams is not arrived at by cognition, but through revelatory experience. And it is not an accession of information, but a modification of the entire being. Mm-hmm. So what kind of knowledge is this? When we say knowledge, we think something that we can learn and then we know it. Okay? Or that it is what we are missing is some vital piece of information. If we only had the whole story, you know, and so we run from pillar to post and from this internet to that internet to get the information that is going to do the trick. But it is not a matter of information. There is nothing somebody can inform you about that is going to do this trick. Well, then what is it? It is an experience of your own. An experience of the essential, deeper reality of yourself and of existence. It's much easier to talk about information. That's what all these books here are, and down in that great big library down below there. I would say 99% and then some, that's all they are, information. Talking about the important things. You know? Theology has been defined, a theologian has been defined as somebody who knows a great deal about God, but nothing of God. You know? Well, that's how it is. We think that if we know more and more about this thing, it's going to work. Well, knowing about is perhaps a good way of being led in the direction, but ultimately we have to know the thing itself and not just about it. You might say, but it's impossible. The Gnostic says it's not impossible. Because you have that kind of a potential, you have a hidden organ inside of yourself, which is capable of doing that. It's hidden because you haven't used it yet. Or you have used it so seldom that it bypasses you. But once you begin to use it, you will see that it is there. And then the experience is revelatory. Because, well, you know, these things have been sort of alluded to in all kinds of psychological ways by modern psychologists. The aha experience, the peak experience, any number of things of that sort. The confrontation with the self, as Jung calls it. But in all of these cases, it is something that opens up a new way of being. Not just more information, not just a cognitive process such as a logical process of induction or deduction, but a breaking into another, a deeper kind of reality. And that modifies one's being. People who have that kind of experience are different thereafter. They have changed. There is a change in the being of the person. Sometimes you can even see the change in the physical appearance of people when they have had experiences of this sort. But it definitely changes them. While people can certainly learn an awful lot of stuff, amass a lot of information, and it doesn't change them one bit. Now, the 11th, which is next to the last, is the awakening, that is the salvation of any individual, is also a cosmic event. You find this in the Gnostic teacher Valentinus, who spoke about this. What this really, it's quite mysterious. But at the same time, I think tremendously hopeful. Because what is meant thereby is that when any individual breaks through into this deeper reality, it alters not only his being, but it alters the cosmos. It alters the entire environment within which he exists. Just precisely how that happens is hard to tell. But at the psychological level, and certainly these matters have a great deal of psychological relevance, Jung spent practically his entire lifetime dealing with them, isn't it true that when you have a profound insight, the entire world looks and feels different? Now you might say, oh, well, that's subjective. It doesn't mean that it has changed. But it certainly has changed as far as you are concerned. And don't you think that the way something feels and is as far as you are concerned is important? It should be terribly important to you. It might not be all that important for somebody else, but it certainly is for you. Now, I don't mean to say thereby that the cosmos within which we live is all our own doing. I am not terribly keen on this New Age notion of everybody creating his own reality, because what that really amounts to in many cases is, I wouldn't mind it if they created their own reality, but they start creating mine. And that's where I draw the line, so to say. Let's say the much more explication of this we will have to leave for some other occasion. But the fact of the matter is that life changes when you change. When you change for the better, life changes for the better. Due to your deeper insight, due to your deeper gnosis, the structure itself changes in some way. Valentinus, the great Gnostic teacher in the classical period of Gnosticism, said, every time a single individual achieves Gnosis, the flaw, the fault in the universe is thereby diminished. Things get a little better. One could argue the details of this, but I think it is definitely a teaching that, strange as it may sound, does have a great deal of merit. And finally, the 12th point, since the whole universal effort is to restore the wholeness and unity of the Godhead, active rebellion against the moral law of the Old Testament is enjoined upon everyone. Now this is Emery's own view, and it's stated in very radical terms, and I would not state it quite that way. It is true that the Gnostics, as I mentioned earlier, like really most of the early Christians, didn't have much use for the Jewish law. They didn't want to eat kosher anymore. They didn't want to get circumcised anymore. In the Gospel of Thomas, one of the Gnostic Gospels, they asked Jesus about circumcision. Should we have the children circumcised? And Jesus says, if the Father wanted them to be circumcised, they would have been begotten that way in their mother's womb. In other words, leave the poor little buggers alone, you know. What's all this foreshortening? What's all this cutting, you know? And can you imagine that in our bloody medical system, in our bloody hospitals, they are still doing this sort of thing routinely without even any religious justification whatsoever, without any anesthetic, without anything? And I was once, I don't know anymore how in the Dickens I ever got in there. It's not a place where they let people in generally, but I was wandering around in a maternity ward at one of our major hospitals a number of years ago. And there I was confronted with a big, bulky battle axe of a nurse, you know. Meanwhile, from one of the corridors came astonishing screaming, you know, incredible screaming, like pigs being stuck or something. I said, what is it? What is it? Well, sir, they are circumcising a couple of little babies. Oh, I said, she said, you know, it doesn't hurt them. I said, they're too little. I said, it doesn't hurt them? Why on earth are they screaming like that? Well, And this was a nurse, you know, big RN right on her it didn't hurt the surgeon, it didn't hurt her. Yeah, that's right. So in any event, you know, all of these different rules and regulations, really these people tried to get away from. But what the way this really should be stated is that the Gnostic position was always to the effect that the observing of commandments, whether they come from Moses or anybody else, in themselves and of themselves are not salvific, which means they are not going to wake you up. You can be a very good, very well-behaved person who never breaks the Ten Commandments, or at least tries not to. Terribly ethical, terribly well-behaved, terribly nice, and still very much asleep. What this means is that rules and commandments and moral laws and so forth that come from religious sources, they all do originally. There is no morality without religion, at least in terms of its origins. These things all may be quite important and quite useful as far as certain worldly objectives are concerned, such as the purposes of society, getting along with each other, leading a more peaceful and ordered and productive life, and all of these are worthwhile objectives. but in them, don't kid yourself. In themselves and of themselves, these things will not make you free. Even in the New Testament, what does Jesus say in the Gospel of St. John? Does he say, observe the commandments and that is going to make you free? No, he says, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be well behaved. I think most people are terribly badly behaved nowadays. I think it's absolutely atrocious and horrible and terrible, and something should be done and they should be beaten up or whatever. just we ourselves should not be beaten up if possible, you know, and all that. But at the same time, let's not confuse these two things. The Gnostics were some of the very few people on the face of the earth. There were some Buddhists and some others elsewhere. He said, look, remember that observing commandments, being a well-behaved, good, moral person, and being enlightened are not the same thing. Behaving well is not going to make you enlightened. It's just going to make you a well-behaved person, which is a worthwhile objective in itself. But if you want to be enlightened, or if you want to be freed, that is, you want to awaken, something else has to happen. Namely, you have to break through into a greater reality, you have to have the knowledge of the things that are, you have to have gnosis. And really, the various religions confuse these categories. And having confused them, they haven't really contributed to the freeing of consciousness, to the enlightenment all that much. I think, while no doubt the salami can always be sliced in a variety of ways, these 12 slices that I have discussed here today are a fairly good skeletal structure of what the content of Gnosticism, of the Gnosis, has been and is. And if one uses these as certain handles in the direction of discovering this reality, then one can go a long ways in that particular effort. So I thank you very much, and bid you good night.